Following interview was conducted with Professor Henry N. Shealy, Associate Professor of Communication for the Purdue University Oral History Program. It took place on Tuesday, May 3, 2011, in his office in Baring Hall. The interviewer was Catherine Marquis. This is part three because part two got a little bit aborted. And he's talking a little bit about his publication, the Charlie Hollick Political Biography.
Okay, do you have any particular question that you'd like to ask?
I was just going to ask, how did you select a publisher?
Well, that was an interesting story. Harper and Row was going to do the book. They wanted me to send the entire book to them. They didn't even want to see a chapter or a sample, and I thought that that's the way it should be done.
Uh-huh.
And one of the fellows from Harper and Row worked with me for almost a year on it, and it's a very interesting story that I'm going to make very brief, and that is that the book was blackballed by one of the members of the trustees of the company, Harper and Row. They didn't want to publish a book on Charlie Hollick, a Republican, and the fellow was a family member of the Kennedy family. And I was very surprised at that because Hollick liked Jack Kennedy very well, worked with him on civil rights, and it was a very unusual thing that happened, and they dropped the project. So I had to go look for another publisher, and it took a while to get one. We got a publishing outfit out of New York to do it, Banner Press, and we wanted to beat the election in 1966. The book was published in 66, and Hollick was going to run. It was his second last term after he got beat by Jerry Ford, which I'll discuss later. We rushed the publication so that we could get it out before the second last campaign of his career. And we went with Banner Books in New York, and that was how that was done.
Mm-hmm.
But it was kind of a shock because we had worked with Harper's, and it was essentially vetoed at the last mm-hmm. minute.
Did you have any book signings at all?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I travel all over not necessarily the country. I'd say it was basically the Washington, D.C. area.
Uh-huh.
I had maybe about 28 different interviews, radio interviews, more than television.
Mm-hmm.
Then all through Indiana, the book was selected as the book of the year. Let's see, what year was it? 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called the Most Distinguished Book of the Year in the biography category by the Indiana University Committee for Indiana Authors. And on Authors Day, they gave me an award or a recognition for publishing the best book of the year. And to get any recognition out of Indiana University was an achievement. Yeah. At that time, and
sure.
So we were quite thrilled with that.
I would think so. That's right.
Sure.
A couple comments on presidential debates. I believe you, sometimes people ask, and the first one, of course, was the Nixon-Kennedy in 1960.
Yes. Studied the political debates in my classes. I taught two key classes. One was called Campaign Communication, where we studied the presidents from Harry Truman through the present. And that brought us up to what we call Obama. I stopped teaching graduate students about 3-4 years ago, so I did not teach the Obama campaign, but we talked about all the other campaigns, the Give 'em Hell, Harry campaign, and then each of the presidential campaigns thereafter, and looked at campaign strategies, advertisements, political speeches that were given in the campaigns, the study of the conventions, and the importance of those nomination speeches and the acceptance addresses and so forth. So that was one of my major courses. And then the other course dealt with the presidential speaking of the candidates after they are elected. And you'll probably notice from the Obama campaign, which I did not teach in class, but basically Obama was a terrific campaigner, no question about it, and his speaking was brilliant. But there is a difference between campaign speaking and then speaking while you are president and running the country at a given time. And so the speeches like the State of the Union address, they are given during the presidency, and those speeches, once you're elected, are a little different than the speeches that are given on the campaign. Mm-hmm. And really, if you trace through a lot of campaign speaking, you'll notice that the policies that were advanced and supported in the campaign are never incorporated once they become president. So the debates that we studied, the first one was the Kennedy-Nixon debate, and that was the most famous debate since the Douglas-Lincoln debates of maybe 100-plus years before. And this debate was really something special. Television had just grown from its infancy to a prominent position, and something like 80 million people would be watching this debate, and it attracted the biggest crowd, I believe, in the history of the TV industry. And that particular debate was actually encouraged and promoted by the television industry, which was struggling a little bit with their I Love Lucy shows and their wrestling contests and whatnot, and television was not refined in the 50s and 60s very much. And they were looking for a good show. And the producers, the leading producers in the TV industry, recommended and asked the two candidates if they would participate in these debates. And there was a problem in terms of the rules of the communication industry that if you let one candidate from one political party speak, you got to let the other one speak. And they made some kind of adjustments that just Kennedy and Nixon could speak, would be legal, would go ahead and do it. And Eisenhower, who actually approved of the concept of presidential debates, recommended that Nixon does not participate. He didn't want Nixon to do it, because Nixon at that point in time was the vice president, had built up an 8-year record as vice president, had participated in the popular Eisenhower administration. Eisenhower won two enormous landslide victories over Adlai Stevenson, the governor of Illinois. And he thought that it would be unwise to share the audience with the lesser-known John F. Kennedy from Massachusetts. So Nixon was a very successful speaker in terms of his Checker speech back in about 1952 when he was selected as vice president. He was accused of accepting something like a $16,000 sum of money to help him with his expenses. And although we think of $16,000 now as a drop in a bucket for a political campaign, when Obama's now talking about getting $2 billion with internet solicitations, etc., he had to defend his perceived illegal and dishonest activities in what was called the Checker speech. And he handled that so well that it saved his job. And he stayed on a ticket. Eisenhower didn't have to drop him. He was certainly thinking of switching and not taking this young, relatively bright senator from California. But that situation gave him, that is Nixon, the confidence that he could do well on television. And in the case of this debate and the campaign, it was the major event of the 1960 campaign. And I can't help but look at the article right here in front of me, because we put on the blackboard for this lecture that I gave. It's called My Final Lecture. We got the totals of that campaign in terms of how close it was. Here it is. JFK got 34 million votes. So did Nixon. JFK got 49.7% of the votes in that campaign. Nixon got 49.6. It was a difference of 112,000 votes that separated that campaign, and this debate was a very significant event in the closest election, I think, in history at that particular time. And Nixon did hurt his knee. Now, I attended the 1960 convention while I was doing research on Halleck for my doctoral dissertation, and I did some research in the galleries and asked people what they thought of primarily Halleck, but Nixon, of course, was the key man. Halleck was the chairman of that convention, because he was a significant leader in the party. He was the minority leader and was asked to preside over the convention. Mm-hmm. And essentially that debate occurred, and Nixon hurt his knee. He bumped his knee and got an infection about a month before the debates, and spent almost 2 full weeks in the hospital. And lost some time in the campaign. He was ahead for a while in the electoral vote, and then on the way to the debates, getting out of the car, Nixon hit his knee again for a second time, and he gave his debate one in what I'd call a pained condition. He didn't look good. His mother called after the debate and asked whether or not he was sick and what had happened to him. And he didn't know he was that bad, but he didn't cooperate with the makeup man and so forth, wore the wrong colored suit, did everything in comparison to Kennedy that was secondary, and did not appear well on debate. Now, I was at a conference at Lyndon Johnson's library, and George Reedy was on a panel with me, and Reedy was Lyndon Johnson's press secretary, and And I was talking about Halleck, and he was talking about Johnson on the panel. He said, what we did in that debate situation is we put, Lyndon and I put all the fellows in the two different rooms. We split up our party. We had about 20 people. This is George Reedy speaking. He's the press secretary. And he said, we put about 10 of them in one room to watch the debates on television, and 10 in the other room to watch it on, or listen to it on radio. And one group came back and said, boy, we won this one. We really took care of that Nixon. And this was the television crowd. Because Kennedy was tanned. He had spent the afternoon up on the roof of the studio where he was staying and just lying in a chair. This is according to Ted Sorensen, who I saw at a Kennedy conference later. And he was tanned, looked young, youthful, and attractive, even though they said that before that debate, only 50% of the people knew who John F. Kennedy was. When he was debating against Nixon, he looked so much better, and he held his own, and all he had to do was indicate that he was as competent and as good as Nixon in terms of intellect, handling the issues, and speaking. And he won that debate on TV. Now, the even the Democratic fellows of George Reedy's group who were at the Johnson Ranch watching this debate, they said that on radio, Nixon won the contest. And for them to admit that their man lost, they were quite worried about it. Fortunately for the Democrats, more people watched this debate on television than they did listening to it. And although some people credit Nixon for winning the last three debates, the impression that Kennedy gave during the first one was so dominant and so appealing that it was regarded as really a major mass media event that influenced the election, and many say Kennedy won that election because of that first TV debate.
Interesting. Yeah. Let's see. Family, I think you talked a little bit about that, and you might mention your wife was in the department. You're both retiring.
Yeah, we are both retiring this week.
Uh-huh.
And actually, she officially taught her last class in December. She wanted to teach until her granddaughter graduated, and it was just she graduated a semester earlier than expected. We were going to she was going to step down in spring, May, 2 weeks from now, but she decided that the granddaughter here was Elizabeth, and she was going to graduate, and she did. She works in the accounting business, Ernst & Young, in Chicago now, and she is through and finished. And our grandson had graduated from Purdue in engineering the year before, and she felt that 25 years was enough, and after helping the department out, she taught only on a half-time basis, but she filled the needs of the department with kind of a roving instructor, and helped when we were short of teachers, and we often were in 114 and sometimes in 315, a speech for technology students. So she decided that her services were enough. 25 years was enough.
Good silver anniversary, right?
And,
yeah. Any awards and honors that you received that you'd like to comment on? Any special?
Well, had to look some of them up before because, you know, I've been here parts of seven decades, and I have won a few.
Mm-hmm.
According to my abbreviated Vita here, I was the number one contributor of articles from the field of communication of refereed academic articles published in Presidential Studies Quarterly from 1987 to 2002. That actually went maybe even beyond that. There was one honor as a member of the roundtable of the first inaugural program in presidential rhetoric that is sponsored by the Center for the Presidential Studies at Texas A&M University. And I was on a panel entitled the 10 of the leading scholars of presidential communication throughout the nation. I consider that an honor. Mm-hmm. I was the nominee for the Outstanding Undergraduate Teaching Award, the Charlie Murphy Award. Charlie Murphy and I actually taught together in the Great Issues class.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a class that was required for seniors at Purdue and dealt with the great issues of war and peace and education and whatnot. They're all kinds of the great issues. I did win the MCL Teaching Award in the School of Humanities, Social Science and Education. That's before we became the liberal arts school. And I won that teaching award. I won that Most Distinguished Book Award in 1966. And there were a couple other teaching awards. The Charles Redding Award for Outstanding Undergraduate Teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my abbreviated.
Mm-hmm.
I got a 31-page Vita over here with several other honors. I had given a top paper at several conventions. And I've done a lot of things that every other professor does, too. So, I mean, I don't think that I
but
was...
But you, the key that. Ones are really nice. That's good.
Yeah.
Now you got about to change the name of your school. As you're retiring, you now got a school.
Right, and I'm thrilled about that. Brian Lamb was one of our undergraduate students in speech here at Purdue. He set up the C-SPAN operation with about three different channels of cable television. He records all the speeches in the U.S. Senate and the speeches in the U.S. House of Representatives, and these are all kept at Purdue, and of course he's conducted interviews with thousands of people that have been prominent from the 70s to the present, and he's done more for what we call the communication arts than just about anybody we know, and we consider it an honor that he has agreed to attach his name to our department. And as an alum, it's a great contribution. So we're very happy to now be called the Brian Lamb School of Communication instead of just the Department of Communication at Purdue University. And now a school.
Right.
And that's great.
Very nice. How about a Purdue tradition? Anyone that comes to mind?
Well,
probably you mentioned maybe earlier that baseball's been kind of good and the sports.
Well, I have done more recruiting probably for the athletic department and ball players and basketball players, football players. And, of course, I probably have attended more baseball games than any faculty member in the history of the university. I dare anyone to name somebody that's seen more Purdue baseball games than Hank Shealy. But those were wonderful experiences, and I have had several All-Americans in my classrooms. I was starting with Rick Mount, who is a Purdue Big Ten icon. He's selected one of the top 10 players in the history of basketball in the conference. He was one of my students. My father, may his soul rest in peace, he saw one game at Purdue. He was my guest. I said, now watch this Rick Mount. He's my student. And Rick Mount set the Big Ten record, which still stands. And this was something like, might have been set around 68, 69, something like that. And it's now 2011. But Rick Mount scored 61 points that night. In one game. 61 points in one game. I heard an interview on the radio with Rick one time, and Rick said that if the three-point rule was in effect, I would have had, I think it was 75 points, give or take one or more. And he was the greatest shooter I think that Indiana has ever produced. And my dad saw that one game, and I'll never forget it. I got to see the first game in Mackey Arena that Rick played in. I will recall that he did something wrong. He had about 6 or 7 seconds left in a tie game against UCLA, and he took a shot. And I said, Rick, that's too quick to run a few more seconds off and through. Well, they got the rebound, went down in the last second. They laid it in, and we lost the game by 2 points. So even if he missed, we would have had overtime, yeah. And we would have had another time to win. So I saw that. And I've had three golden girls in class, and the gal in black I had. And the gal in black once gave a speech where she twirled her baton, and she had a knife. I don't know what this was made of, but it was a sword. And in the classroom, she twirled this sword across, and I ducked, and I told everybody to lie low, because I didn't want her to cut the head off of any of my students. And it looks awful scary. But she performed this little demonstration on twirling, and it was quite an incident, too. But I do appreciate all the All-Americans I had, especially Katie Douglas and Joy Holmes, and then Glenn Robinson, the big dog. And I had many great basketball players. Everett Stevens, I'm proud that Everett's now sending his son to Purdue. He'll be in one of the future recruiting classes. And I had an opportunity to have a number of these athletes, male and female, attend my course in public speaking. I got to put in one plug for my course, Comp 314, because Simon & Schuster published a book relating to the top 200 colleges in America and what were the recommended courses, the top four courses at each of these different colleges. And the recommended course, according to the students and whatnot, and all who participated in this poll at Purdue, was one of the four was Comm 314, which is my advanced public speaking class, which a lot of the athletes took. They knew that Hank would excuse him for the athletic events because he was a college athlete himself and knew that these trips were necessary. A number of my colleagues who I lived on with on Chauncey Street, and I won't mention names, but they did not appreciate the fact that these athletes would miss class to go to play a basketball game or a football game. Actually, the football wasn't that much of a problem. They didn't miss as many classes. But the basketball and baseball players had to miss classes because a lot of those games were played at one of the days during the week. And I would always give them an opportunity to make it up. I do have a story to tell about Joe Sexton. Joe Sexton just died yesterday or the day before. And he was a great coach, one of the greatest athletes that Purdue ever acquired, Mr. Basketball in Indiana, great baseball player, baseball coach at Purdue. And I had to let Rick Mount out of class for about 2 weeks for some kind of McDonald's All-American type of tournament that was going on when Rick was about a junior, I guess, or a sophomore in college. It wasn't the high school McDonald's All-American thing, but it was some function. And I said, well, I'll let Rick go for 2 weeks if he makes up the work. Well, Rick didn't make up the work, so I had to give him an incomplete. And I said, what we'll do is, Rick, you come in the summer, you take this work and you do it in the summer. And he never would show up to class. So I called up the athletic department, and Joe Sexton said, I'll get him over there. And he brought him over there, and he made the make-up speeches. And we got it done, and we passed them, and we kept them eligible. But it took a little effort. I guess that Joe said that Rick was a little embarrassed because he looked in the window at the class that I had, and it was something like 11 girls for every boy. And there were about two boys in the class, and he was a little bashful. And he didn't want to have to give his speeches before all these girls. But got him to do it, and he did well.
Yeah. How about an outstanding event? Anything special comes to mind? We have more than one.
Well, the events were, of course, Jess and I went to the Rose Bowl game, and we did like the Rose Bowl. That was sure a special event, and we've been to many of the functions of the university,
mm-hmm.
and I would say probably the Rose Bowl was the biggest event that we went and saw Drew Brees play, and of course Drew Brees became the cover boy like Rick Mount was. Rick Mount was the cover boy as a high school basketball player on Sports Illustrated, and it took Drew Brees to win the Super Bowl before he got on the cover, but they both made it, and some of our Purdue guys have really done a lot for the national publicity of the university, and I think some of our sports members are underrated in terms of their contribution to the publicity of the school.
In closing, is there anything I forgot to ask or anything you'd like to add?
Well,
post-retirement, post-Purdue.
Okay, I am retiring a year earlier than I expected, and I've been so wrapped up in the procedures for getting out that I haven't thought beyond the day, which is about 10 days from now when I retire.
Yeah.
And when I go home tonight, I will have to read the Purdue health plan and the retirement procedures and so forth. And I'll work on it.
You're planning to stay in the community, though.
But I intend to stay here. The Purdue community has been good to me. Mrs. Shealy has been active in the community. She is the first chairman of the Feast of the Hunter's Moon, started this event as a co-chairman, and this event brings in $1 million a year now to the community. She was president of the school board in West Lafayette, one of the finest high schools in the state of Indiana. And we were happy to be part of that and live right next to the high school, a block or two away. And we like the area. And we think that Indiana's underrated. People can call it a flyover state if they want to. But we'll stay here and watch all the events that are on campus and watch the convocations and enjoy life in the Big Ten.
Sounds good. Thank you, Dr. Shealy. I appreciate that very much.